Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Joining us, Elizabeth Norton.
Hi.
Oh, hi. I was just, hi. And, well, we're so glad that you joined us and you're calling in all the way from the UK. And you're covering an area that we love a lot, and that's the monarchy. And, of course, we're talking about the Tudors tonight. First of all, with yourself, how did you get involved in this sort of research? Like, what led you to start writing about these subjects?
It's always been a period that I've been fascinated with. The Tudor period, it's the first time that we've really got the sources to look in detail at individual people. We can know something about what they were thinking in a way that we don't have in earlier periods. So it's fascinating. I came from an archaeology background, historical archaeology, and then moved across to history. So I'm interested in sort of the material culture for life and what sort of exists. And that moved me into the Tudor period, and it's just such a fascinating time.
It's amazing. When did you start writing?
It's probably about 10 years ago now. My first book came out probably about 10 years ago. That was on notorious medieval queens, and actually took them into the Tudor period. And that was just fascinating to research because it's all the sort of historical bad women, really.
Yeah. They could keep writing those now.
That's right.
So now you you're really into the historical part. And was there any particular reason that it's been so far? Like, what I'm saying is, do you think you'll ever change what you write about, get outside of what you're doing now and start writing into other areas?
I don't think so. I mean, I've gone back into the medieval period a few times, but the Tudors are just fascinating. There are so many big personalities. There's, of course, Anne Boleyn, the second wife of Henry VIII. There's Henry VIII himself, Elizabeth I. It's just full of big personalities and just absolutely fascinating. There is so much to explore.
Right. How do you find it when you're researching? Because it's all kind of past and at one thing, so it's at a distance. But it's also, you've got to deal with people's own biases. And when you're trying to research someone that's been a king or a queen or in the monarchy of somehow, isn't it a little guarded to find any real information?
It can be tricky. I like to go back to the original sources, so the actual manuscripts themselves, because they can tell you a great deal. So For example, I was recently researching Thomas Seymour, who was an uncle of King Edward VI, Henry VIII's son. And, I mean, going back to the originals of his letters, you can actually look at his handwriting. So towards the end of his life, he was in the Tower of London, and his handwriting just goes to pieces, and so he's absolutely terrified. So you can learn a lot by looking at the actual documents that they wrote. You can also get an insight into them. Letters tend to be quite stylized in the period, so you have to bear in mind that they're writing in a particular way. Often other sources contradict what you've read, so it's difficult. You have to be aware that there's bias, and of course that people are human. They saw themselves in a particular way, and that's how they wanted to present themselves. So you're working with a potentially quite skewed lot of material. But, I mean, that's part of the fun in researching and interpreting and trying to work out just what happened and what people were doing and what they were thinking.
Do you ever have any feedback that's kind of not necessarily, it's a little bit more negative than positive about the writings? Is there people that want to see their favorite emperor, I guess, in a certain light? And if something comes out that necessarily isn't so, you know, so pretty about something or some person, and you write about it, do people take offense?
Absolutely. The people who are alive to 500 years ago are still highly relevant today. The most obvious figure is Anne Boleyn. She almost has a fan club today. She's incredibly polarizing. People love her or they hate her. And it was always the way with Anne Boleyn back in the 16th century. She polarized opinions, and it's still going on today. So, yeah, I mean, if you write something about Anne Boleyn that's not favorable, you're going to upset people. Equally, if you write a very favorable picture of her, you upset people who see her as sort of a she-devil who destroyed Henry VIII's marriage to Catherine of Aragon. So it's difficult. I try to ignore it and just look at how I see them and how the sources speak to me about what they were doing and how I present them. Of course you upset people, but history is all about research and debate and interpretation. So in some ways it's great that we can still have a debate about these characters that lived 500 years ago.
And this is a sort of a twisted angle here, but, you know, there's so many stories of Anne Boleyn and her ghost still haunting. And you doing all the research and have traveled, and you've been to a lot of the castles, and I'm sure you've been everywhere you need it. Have you ever come across any of those situations where they talk about?
There are certainly a number of stories relating to Anne Boleyn's ghost and some other Tudor figures. I've not come across anything directly myself. My grandfather, who died years ago, used to tell a story. He worked for the Department of Ancient Monuments in the war, and he apparently had a friend who was locking up at Hampton Court one night. He was working at Hampton Court and claimed that the ghost of a Tudor lady walked through him on the stairs. So he always thought that was Anne Boleyn, apparently. So I don't know. It's interesting. It's fascinating. I believe Anne Boleyn is supposed to appear at Blickling, her birthplace, on the anniversary of her execution. There are also, I was told recently about a ghost story connected with Lambeth Palace that's supposed to be Anne Boleyn. So I don't know. It's fascinating. There are certainly a lot of stories.
Yeah. I was just wondering if you ever felt anything, like when you were around, do you feel a difference in the place that you're in? It's kind of precognitive. You already sort of know what the history is when you're there. So what's happened is in your mind. But I was just wondering if you've ever picked up, as you'd say, vibes or feelings from certain areas that seem to have, you know, weird feelings, like ghostly.
Not really, to be honest. I'm not very sensitive.
No, but that's good. I just like to hear from people that who are just out there researching, doing a book like yourself, or doing things, and they go to these places and. How is it for you? Like, do you go and you kind of feel, wow, like someone's watching you? Or
yeah, I mean, I get a sense of presence in that, you know, this is, if I go to somewhere where the character I'm researching lived and moved, I get a sense of them being there in some ways. But no, I'm afraid that I don't particularly get vibes that they're watching me or there. I'd like to very much, but Sadly, no.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, I know, it's a shame.
I'm sure it's better for you. But
I probably scared with this, actually. Yeah.
No. So now on your latest book, now it's just came out in the UK, and it'll be coming out here in January. And so now tell us about that. Like what is the initial, what is the book about?
So the book is called The Temptation of Elizabeth Tudor, and it focuses on Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn's daughter, Elizabeth, the future Queen Elizabeth. It begins at Henry VIII's death when Elizabeth is 13 years old. And it follows her up until 1549. And it's what it is, it's looking at a very specific incident in her life. When Henry VIII died, she was left an orphan. She was too young, really, to set up her own household. So she went to live with her stepmother, Catherine Parr. Catherine very rapidly remarried Thomas Seymour, who was the uncle of the new king, Edward VI. What Catherine didn't know was that Thomas had already proposed marriage to Elizabeth, who turned him down. And very soon after she joined the household and Thomas joined the household, he began acting in a very inappropriate way. There are records of him coming into her bedroom in the morning and tickling her in bed and looking as though he was going to come in there with her. He would appear, and this is a quote, bare-legged and in his slippers, and would come into her room. One stage he would slap her and spank her playfully. At one stage the Queen was holding her in the garden while he pulled out his dagger and slashed her dress. So there's a lot of very inappropriate behaviour, which I've been looking at in great detail. It eventually came to a head when Catherine Parr found the pair embracing and she sent Elizabeth away. Catherine Parr then died not long afterwards, and then the book looks at the fall of Thomas Seymour, because he basically then turned his attentions to Elizabeth, this time with a view to marrying her. So he eventually lost his head. Elizabeth was in considerable danger for a period, but survived. And, I mean, the argument of the book is that this all went a long way to creating the image of the Virgin Queen. It was just another proof to Elizabeth that marriage could be dangerous and costly. So that's the book. And, yeah, I'm hoping that it will prove popular. And it was fascinating to do such a short period of research and such a detailed amount of research.
Yeah. How long does something like that take you? Like to do all the research and put all that together, what was the timing on all that?
It takes about 18 months in total. So it's probably about roughly just under a year for researching and then just over 6 months for actually writing.
Was there anything that really happened that you found in your research that sort of surprised you? Sort of like, you know, you kind of have something in your mind, the framework, you kind of know some of the story, you're going in, and were there some big surprises for you?
So there were a number of surprises. I think for me the biggest surprise was just how willingly Princess Elizabeth seems to have taken Thomas Seymour's suit after Catherine died. I had sort of always assumed it was quite a one-sided relationship, really. And actually, my reading of the sources, you'll see in my book that I think Elizabeth was actually quite a willing participant, at least in the marriage negotiations after Catherine's death. So that surprised me a great deal. There's also, there were rumours of a baby being born, and there's a chapter devoted to that in the book. And I'm not going to give away the conclusion, but I mean, certainly there was a lot of surprising information there, and it was great to really dig deep at the story and pick away at what people were saying and what actually happened.
And so did you come up with a different kind of feeling on Elizabeth than you had before you went through the book and the research?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think I'm guilty of it, and I'm sure other people are, of viewing Elizabeth I from the perspective of this great queen. When actually in 1547 and 1548, Elizabeth was a teenage princess. She had, at that stage, she had very little hope of the throne. Her brother was young and healthy and gave every indication that he would grow up and marry and have children. She also had an elder sister, Mary, who might well have married and had children. So at that stage, Elizabeth was very unlikely to be queen. It was not something that she was looking for. So it was interesting to take her at that sort of moment in her life and look at what she was thinking, what she was feeling.
Yeah, it would have been very interesting. What do you think she had in mind for her life then?
I think she was looking for marriage, to be honest. Her future really was either as a great noblewoman in England, probably married to a nobleman, or possibly a foreign marriage for diplomatic reasons. And because of the way her parents' marriage ended and the fact that her father declared her illegitimate, the chances of her making a very good foreign marriage weren't that high. So really, I think she had a view to being a great nobleman's wife, to be honest. And Thomas Seymour was the greatest man unmarried in England, as her governess told her after Catherine Parr died.
Right. And so, but do you think that it was still would have been, I mean, there was still quite the religious problem in the fact of, you know, the way she was made illegitimate was really about the church, the way he made the Church of England, that whole setup. Do you think she still would have had a good chance at it? Do you know, marrying a nobleman?
She was incredibly eligible. The problem was that the council, the king's council, had to consent to her marriage, and they were unlikely to do that while the king was a minor. But when the king was an adult, it's quite likely he would have permitted her to marry. So, yeah, I think that's no problem. It was a problem abroad, because a lot of the princes of Europe thought that she was illegitimate. So that was quite a big problem. It wasn't insurmountable. She did get offers from foreign princes, but they tended to be more minor. So she probably wasn't going to end up being Queen of France, for example.
Right. And so how did that play on her mentally? Was this really tough?
Absolutely. She had a very troubled childhood in general, Elizabeth. Her mother was executed when she was two. She was declared illegitimate. She would have been very aware of what had happened to her mother. And there were, in the period, it was believed that a woman who was guilty of sort of adultery and impropriety could pass that on to her children. So there were many that would believe that Elizabeth, as the daughter of such a mother, could be capable of sexual impropriety. And so she was looked at with suspicion in some respect. Her half-sister, Princess Mary, in fact, later claimed that she thought Elizabeth had the look of Smeaton about her. And Smeaton was one of the men rumoured to have been Anne Boleyn's lover. So she was basically claiming that she wasn't Henry VIII's daughter at all. So this all had a huge effect on Elizabeth. I think it made her fiercely protective of her royal status and her father's memory, simply because she wanted to prove to the world that she was royal, she was his daughter. And so she was proud of her rank and her status.
But how did her relationship with her father, Henry, actually go? I mean, it was such, like, did they have much of one?
They didn't have very much direct contact. Once she was declared illegitimate and her mother was dead, he, in fact, didn't bother to send her any new clothes for quite some time. There's a letter from her governess complaining that she's got nothing to wear because she's outgrown them. As she grew up, she had a bit more contact. She was present at Catherine Parr and Henry VIII's wedding in 1543, but she was still young and the contact was quite indirect. She sent him a New Year's gift as a teenager, which she'd written herself. It was a translation work. So she was obviously fond of him and in awe of him, but I think they didn't have the sort of father-daughter relationship that we would sort of expect today. But again, equally, he didn't really have that relationship with any of his children. He was a distant parent, as Tudor kings and queens were. Children were sent away to their own households at an early age. But so the direct contact wasn't necessarily there, but she was very much aware of who her father was and was proud of that.
Wow. And so that carried on, I would suppose, to her sister as well, like Mary, who was quite opposite, I would guess. They didn't have much of a relationship either, and they probably felt a little competition.
Yeah, I think the relationship between Mary and Elizabeth is just hugely complicated. Obviously, Mary was the daughter of Henry VIII's first wife, who was put aside when Mary was a teenager so that Henry could marry Anne Boleyn. For Mary, this was hugely traumatic. She sided with her mother in the divorce, and was later forced by Henry to admit that her parents had never been married and that she was illegitimate, something that deeply upset her. In spite of that, she actually was very kind to Elizabeth when Elizabeth was young. After Anne Boleyn's death, Mary wrote a letter talking about what a good child she was and how sweet she was. She was very interested in her, but it was difficult as Elizabeth grew up and came to resemble Anne Boleyn more. It was difficult for Mary. The problem was Mary was almost 20 years older than her sister. She was in her late teens when she was born. And actually the contrast between them must have been quite stark. When Mary became queen, she was in her late 30s. Elizabeth was still only 20. So the contrast must have been uncomfortable for the queen. And then, of course, there was the religious difference. Mary was Catholic. Elizabeth was Protestant. Elizabeth conformed during Mary's reign, but she didn't do so very willingly. She went to mass complaining loudly that her stomach hurt and that she was ill, something that displeased the Queen. So it was a difficult relationship, and it does stem from their childhood and the fact of who their mothers were.
And Mary didn't last very long as the Queen either, didn't she? Wasn't she insane or something?
Yeah, Mary was Queen for 5 years. She actually died of the flu. Which actually I think most people were quite glad about in England, to be honest. Mary was quite an unfortunate character. She came to the throne on a wave of popular support. Her brother Edward had appointed the Protestant Jane Grey as heir, but Mary was swept to power really by a popular movement. So she always believed that was God's work and that it was God's plan that she'd be queen. For her, that meant returning England to the Catholic Church. By that stage, a lot of people in England were Protestant, and so she began burning them. Many people were burned during her reign, which didn't look good for her, hasn't done well for her reputation. She's known as Bloody Mary. She was also highly disappointed. She married Philip of Spain but failed to have a child, and eventually had to appoint Elizabeth as his successor, something that she hated. So she's not necessarily insane, but she was certainly an incompetent ruler and one that didn't preside over a very happy period.
Well, why was she not just put in? Why did Edward appoint Lady Jane? Because Edward was quite young when he died, wasn't he? He was still a teenager, wasn't he?
He was. He was 15. He wrote, when he knew he was dying, he wrote a device for the succession, where he declared that his two sisters, Mary and Elizabeth, were illegitimate and couldn't inherit, and passed the throne instead to Jane Grey, who was the daughter of his first cousin, Frances Brandon. And the main reason for that is that she was Protestant. Edward was an incredibly fervent Protestant, even in spite of his young age, and was very, very worried about the prospect of Mary succeeding. He couldn't choose Elizabeth over Mary. That wasn't possible. So he dropped both from the succession and planted Jane in there instead. It was probably helped by the fact that the head of his council, the Duke of Northumberland, was Jane's father-in-law. So he was probably also pushing for Jane's succession. But the driving force seems to have been Edward, and it was a religious motive.
Hmm. And Lady Jane was just beheaded. She actually never got crowned, did she?
No, she was queen technically for 9 days. She was declared queen and taken to the tower, where she got to try on the crown, but she was never crowned. She was sitting eating dinner one day in the tower when the cloth of estate, which was sort of a canopy that would be over the monarch, was torn down, and she was sent down to the prison part of the tower.
Wow. And so one thing that, now, a lot of people, there's just talking about beheading royalty, I hear a lot of different stories and being there. Now, when you're in the Tower of London and you're at the area where the royalty was being beheaded.
Yeah.
Now, I've heard truthfully that they never got beheaded there, that all royalties, like as in king or queen, like Jane, would be beheaded inside.
That's right.
Oh,
so,
okay. Yeah.
So they were inside the tower. So what it is most executions happened on Tower Green, which is outside the walls of the tower, and there would be a huge crowd of people. There would be jeering and shouting, and it's a horrible place to die. It was very, very public. a very, very select few, and that included Jane Grey, Anne Boleyn, Catherine Howard, Henry VIII's fifth wife, were executed inside the walls of the Tower of London on Tower Green. So that was much more private because they could control who came in and who came out of the tower and basically shut the gates. So it was much, much better to be executed there, but very few people were.
But so there was a separate, so it wasn't broad, like everybody couldn't, because, you know, on television shows and stuff, they show like Anne Boleyn's being beheaded and they, you know, put her out there and they make a big spectacle and everybody's throwing things and saying things and they cut her head off. That really didn't happen.
No, I mean, there was a big crowd, but it was an invited audience. The king's illegitimate son, Henry Fitzroy, was there, as were much of his council and the nobility. Foreigners were expressly excluded. They weren't to be admitted. The common people wouldn't have been allowed in. So there was a crowd, but it was an invited crowd. It was the people who were there to witness the death. So there wouldn't have been a baying crowd.
Right. And it would have been inside.
So it was inside the walls of the tower. It was right. Still outside. It was okay. on a patch of grass inside the tower.
Okay. So it was done, but it was done separately.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
It wasn't just an open door policy.
No, not at all. And it would be on a scaffold that was built specifically for that execution.
Oh, okay. They actually handmade.
That's right. So they would be, while you were locked in the tower, you would hear the carpenters working to build the scaffold for you to die.
Well, that's very polite. That's...
Yes, yes. So horrible.
Well, that's lovely. No, just I've heard stories on that. We're talking about beheading, and I just wasn't sure what was what there, because you see it, you know, of course, television and movies always have that, you know, they want to make it entertainment, so of course.
They do, yeah. I mean, actually, there's one royal beheading I can think of that was indoors, and that was Mary Queen of Scots at Fotheringay Castle. That was in the Great Hall.
Oh, okay.
But in the main, they were outside, but within the Tower of London.
But the Mary Queen of Scots didn't rank or
she wasn't in London.
Yeah.
So she was never in the Tower. She was kept prisoner at Fotheringay, her execution was very hurried and quite secret. So that I suspect is why it was indoors.
Right, right. So now with Elizabeth here, so did she when it happened and she became queen? I mean, at the initial turnover too, like the changeover, was she worried for her life?
Absolutely. She was an unknown quantity, but she was also a Protestant. She was widely known to be Protestant. So there were dangers. She was certainly, later in life, she was very paranoid about assassination. But there were always dangers. But of course, there was actually quite a lot that could kill you in Tudor England. Elizabeth actually did nearly die in 1562, and she'd been queen for 4 years, but she nearly died of smallpox rather than any assassination attempt.
And so who would have taken the role from her at the beginning if she would have died?
People weren't sure. Legally, the heir to the throne was Catherine Grey, Jane Grey's sister, and that came from Henry VIII's will. By the third act of succession, which Henry VIII passed, he basically said that he could appoint whomever he wanted to be his successor. Then in his will, he left the throne to his three children in turn, and then to the descendants of his younger sister, Mary, rather than his elder sister, Margaret, who was Mary, Queen of Scots in the Scottish line. So legally, the heir was Catherine Grey, who was the senior descendant of his younger sister. By the rules of hereditary, the heir was Mary, Queen of Scots, who was then in France in 1562. So it was difficult. No one was quite sure. A lot of the Elizabeth's council wanted the Earl of Huntingdon, who was much more distantly related but was male. So they wanted a king. So it was very up in the air. It probably would have been Catherine Grey, but it may not have been. So the fear of Elizabeth dying was enormous for her council.
What was there a real fear of England kind of losing its power or strength by not having a man? Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Before the 16th century, there'd never been an effective ruling queen. The only example in England, anyway, the only example in England was the Empress Matilda, who was the only living legitimate child of King Henry I in the 12th century. He named her his heir. But when he died, his nephew Stephen claimed the crown, and that ushered in nearly 20 years of civil war as Stephen and Matilda fought for the crown. Matilda actually nearly won it. She had Stephen imprisoned and went to London for her coronation, but was driven out by the people. And so it wasn't a happy precedent. In the 15th century, most people agreed that the true heir to the throne was Elizabeth of York, but no one was prepared to support her. She was the mother of Henry VIII by marrying Henry VII. So it was a benefit to Henry VIII to have her as his mother because she had a very strong claim to the throne. But no one thought that she could be queen herself. So the idea of a queen ruling was actually quite frightening for Henry VIII and a lot of people because people were worried it would lead to civil war. There was also the danger that the husband of a queen became a king. When Mary I married Philip of Spain, he became King Philip of England. It didn't last. When she died, he stopped being King of England. But there was always a danger that you would end up with a foreign king and lose your independence.
Right, right. And so what was with Elizabeth here? Now some of the names like the Virgin Queen, were they popular sayings back at the time when she was ruling? Or
yes.
Oh, they were. So what was kind
yes,
of,
absolutely.
What was the reasoning behind something, let's say, like the Virgin Queen? Like, what was that?
It's very much a part of Elizabeth's myth. Very soon after she became queen, she was petitioned by Parliament to marry, and she declared that she wanted to remain a virgin for her life and that she wouldn't. And it actually didn't cause much of a stir, and to be honest, it was because nobody believed her. Nobody thought it was possible for a queen to remain unmarried and to rule alone. But it was very much part of the myth, and what Elizabeth was trying to build up for herself, her persona, her public persona. She made a big thing about her virginity and the fact that she was a virgin queen, and so did writers in her reign. It was very important, and it's very much part of her myth that she was building.
And so I'm just trying to think what the myth was trying to accomplish. Is it to make her stronger as a female?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in part, she would have been very aware that were she to marry, she would lose a great deal of her power because the husband of the queen was king. So she would go from being, she said that she would have but one mistress and no master in England. And it was a good point, because if she married, she would revert somewhat to being a queen consort. She'd be a little more important than a queen consort, but she wouldn't be ruling alone anymore. So on a personal level, it was not something that she welcomed. But also, as the Virgin Queen, she could set herself apart from other women and appear different to other women. So it was an age where women were considered inferior to men. So she, by ruling independently and as this Virgin Queen, a sort of mythological figure, she could set herself apart. It also, she used an analogy that she was married to her country, which again was something that she could do as an unmarried queen.
And so now, that is, what is the difference then now as compared to, because I mean, when Queen Elizabeth II hears in and she's been married to a man, she still holds the leadership as the queen. Her husband is the king, but not really.
That's he's not the king.
That's what I mean. Like, could you kind of explain what the difference is? I mean, because like she married someone, Prince Philip, and I'm not sure what the difference is between that and then.
It's simply that times have changed. So, back in the 16th century and in the medieval period before it, it was believed that a man would become king through his wife, so he would take the crown matrimonial. Henry VII, in fact, Elizabeth's grandfather, was very worried that if he married Elizabeth of York, who was the daughter of Edward IV, before he was crowned king, it would look as though he had the crown matrimonial. He was a king by courtesy. It was widely accepted that the husband of a queen became a king. That has changed considerably over time, and in fact, in the early 18th century, there was a reigning queen called Queen Anne in England, and she was married, but he didn't become king. So it had changed before that point. But in the Tudor period, it was assumed that a woman couldn't rule alone.
Wow. Times have changed.
Very much.
Wow. And so do you think that Elizabeth had a long-term goal? I mean, it sounds to me like... you know, the Virgin Queen concept and the idea of doing this is kind of like, in her mind, she'll never get married then, she'll never have children. Was that kind of really her long-term goal?
Yeah, no, I think it was. I think Elizabeth's long-term goal was to hold the throne and to die naturally as Queen of England. That was her long-term goal. It would have been better for her dynasty if she had married and had children, and that the Tudor dynasty could have continued. But when a queen in the 16th century had a son, she actually produced a rival. You can see it in the case of Mary, Queen of Scots. Mary, Queen of Scots, had been Queen of Scotland since she was a baby. She had a son, and immediately people's attention turned towards him because most people wanted a king rather than a queen. So if you were a queen who had a son, you had an incredibly powerful rival. There would certainly have been calls for Elizabeth, if she hadn't a son by the time he became an adult, for her to pass on authority to him, because people wanted a king. Women could transmit a claim to the throne, but it was still quite a new idea that they actually would reign themselves.
Wow. And so how did she plan on changing England?
Her most immediate change was she wanted to turn England back to the Protestant Church. She'd conformed to Catholicism under Mary's reign, but most people knew that she was Protestant. In fact, it was difficult for her to find a bishop to crown her at her coronation because it was widely believed that she was a heretic from the Catholic point of view. So she was certainly Protestant. But what Elizabeth did with her religious settlement was very clever, because she trod a middle line. So although she was, it's Protestant and a Protestant church, wasn't as radically Protestant as the church of her half-brother. So she actually did a very clever settlement, and one that endures today. And it's a very pragmatic settlement, and it's probably her finest achievement, and it was the first thing that she wanted to do.
And so, I'm trying to encapsulate the whole. Do you think that she would have, like, she lasted a really long time as the queen? Do you think she thought she had that long of time?
As I said, you can die at any point in Tudor right. England. There's lots that will carry you off. But so, I mean, certainly I'm sure she was pleased. She lived to be nearly 70 and reigned for 44 years. So she had a lot of time. The last decade or so of her reign was quite a troubled period. She faced a rebellion by the Earl of Essex, which was designed to imprison her. She also had war in Ireland and in the Netherlands, and there was high inflation and unemployment. So it was quite a difficult time. So her reign sort of divides into different sections. Had she died in 1588, which is about 15 years before she died, after the defeat of the Spanish Armada, certainly her contemporaries would have viewed her as a very, very great queen. It was coloured slightly by the last decade of her reign, and by the time of her death, most people were looking forward to a new reign. But, I mean, it was an enormous achievement, and in living so long, she was able to bring a period of stability into England.
Do you think she had a true great love in her life?
Yes, and that would be Robert Dudley. He was the son of the Duke of Northumberland, the man who put Jane Grey on the throne. He and Elizabeth were both imprisoned in the Tower of London at the same time. She was imprisoned under her sister for a period. They were very, very close. Certainly, he had hopes that she would marry him. Unfortunately, he was married when she came to the throne, and his wife died not long afterwards in suspicious circumstances. She was found at the foot of a flight of stairs with a broken neck. That basically meant that Elizabeth could never marry Robert Dudley, because it would be said that he had killed his wife to make room for her. But he, all through her life, until his death in 1588, he was there for her, and she was very close to him. So I think if she could have married any man, she would have married him.
Wow, amazing story. So now, in your book itself, what exactly was the focus in your book?
So the focus in the book is on the relationship between Elizabeth and Thomas Seymour, and it's looking at what was actually going on between them and what they both hoped to achieve by the relationship. So it divides quite nicely into two sections, really, before Catherine Parr's death and afterwards, when he became available to Elizabeth as a husband. So I really wanted to look at a moment in Elizabeth's life before she became the Virgin Queen and before she had any prospect of becoming a queen, and see exactly what was going on and what she was thinking about and what she was planning. And it was fascinating.
Right. Now, Catherine Parr, for that, now she was the husband of Henry VIII.
Or yes, that's right. She was his sixth wife.
Yeah. And Thomas Seymour was her brother?
He was the brother of Jane Seymour, Henry's third wife. Yes.
it's just tough for me to keep going.
You
know? Yes. I knew there was a relationship. So Thomas Seymour was kind of playing with Elizabeth from a very young age.
Yes, he was. She was 13 when her father died, and when he joined the household that she was living in. She was 14 for most of the period. And turned 15 towards the end of his life. So, no, she was a teenager.
Yeah.
From 14, she was technically marriageable, but he was considerably older than her. He was in his 40s.
Right. And so, what did they just go out, hang out with each other then? Is that sort of...
Well, they were living together. I mean, they were living together. He was a sort of a stepfatherly role, but there was quite a lot going on in the household. So there was, he was coming into her bedchamber in the morning to say good morning to her. But it was all quite scandalous. the reports of him climbing into the bed to tickle her in the morning and her having to hide to stop him getting to her. So there was quite a scandal, but it was all quite hushed up until his actual fall a year or so later.
Wow. And so do you think she actually liked him?
Yes, absolutely. He was very charming, very handsome. I think she did like him very much indeed. Years later, she was given a portrait of him when she was queen, and she hung it in one of her palaces. So it shows that she was thinking of him and remembered him.
Yeah, it's amazing. Amazing. And so how did it end for Elizabeth, so for the people that don't know?
With regard to the Seymour scandal or Elizabeth in general?
Well, actually, the Seymour scandal would be great.
Yeah, well, Seymour was hugely jealous of his elder brother, Edward, the Duke of Somerset, who was the Lord Protector. So he was effectively regent for Edward VI. Thomas Seymour wanted to share that power and his brother wouldn't share it. So he continued to try and undermine his brother. After Catherine Parr's death, he became more bold. He was negotiating a marriage with Elizabeth. At the same time, he was in league with a man who was counterfeiting coins at the Bristol Mint with a view to paying an army that he would use against his brother. Matters came to a head when this man, the coiner, William Charington, was arrested in January 1549. And I think that moved Thomas Seymour's plans forward. He had to act or risk arrest. And one night in the palace, the palace was awakened by the sound of a dog barking. When they went outside, they found the king's pet dog stabbed to death outside the door to his bedroom. And the guard said they'd seen Thomas Seymour lurking around the palace. So it was assumed that he tried to kidnap the king. The next day, he was sent to the Tower of London. In the tower, everything that had been going on with Elizabeth came out. She was interrogated, her servants were imprisoned, and Thomas was interrogated. And eventually he was executed. And Elizabeth was quite lucky, I think. She was very closely interrogated, but she and her servants said very little and ultimately survived.
Wow. So she had to live with that.
Absolutely.
And so then what was next for her after that? That was before she was queen. Did they send her away or was she punished for that?
Not particularly. She lost her governess for a time. A new lady mistress was appointed for her who she didn't like. But no, she was gradually rehabilitated. She spent the rest of her brother's reign wearing somber black and ensuring that she was an upstanding Protestant maiden. So she survived. She was rehabilitated. After Edward's death, she appeared at her sister Mary's court, but the pair were not particularly friendly. There was a rebellion against Mary in 1554, and Elizabeth was implicated in it. That led to her being sent to the Tower of London herself, and she must have been in fear of her life. She was eventually released, but was never really on friendly terms with her sister. Eventually, her sister died, and she became queen.
Wow. And so, and one thing, when she became queen, now she did things quite differently. Didn't she change the way people looked? Isn't she the one that, like, changed the way a lady queen would be by cutting her hair and the makeup and everything?
That's a bit of a myth, I'm afraid. She certainly, as she got older, she wore makeup and wigs, but it wasn't a deliberate policy. It was more to continue to appear as youthful as possible. There was a myth that she was ageless and that she remained as beautiful as she'd ever been when she was in her 60s. I think there's quite a lot of poetic license there. Yeah. She wore a great deal of white makeup to hide smallpox scars and wrinkles. Her teeth had mainly fallen out or turned black by that period because of sugar, and her hair was largely gone, so she wore wigs. But it wasn't really a deliberate policy. It was more an attempt to continue looking youthful.
Right. And so overall, do you think she did a good reign? I mean, as in things were well for the country?
Yes. No, I think she was a very great queen. She wasn't warlike. She kept England out of foreign wars in the main until she was really forced into it. She presided over a very stable period when 100 years before there had been civil war in England, the Wars of the Roses, which had caused huge turmoil and troubles. So it was a very stable period. It wasn't an unremitting success. There was inflation and unemployment towards the end of the reign. Most people were looking for a change by the time she died, but certainly she was a very great queen and presided over a period of a great period in English history. There was the defeat of the Spanish Armada, which was a huge invasion fleet sent by Spain, and that was repulsed. There was an upsurge in exploration in the reign, invention. There's a theatre, literature. So it's a golden age in English history, and she was very much at the helm.
And how did she finally pass?
She died. She was 69 years old. Her cousin, Countess of Nottingham, died, and Elizabeth became depressed. She then really just became ill. She had a sore throat that she couldn't shake off. Even to the end, though, she remained defiant. She refused to go to bed, even though her doctor said that she should. And when one of her servants suggested she go to bed, she'd say, "Little man, who are you to tell the Queen of England what to do?" Eventually, she went to bed. And she lay there in silence until she died. She refused to name her successor to the end, something that she'd always refused to do because she was frightened that people would flock to the heir to the throne, leaving her. So, yeah, she died of old age, effectively. In that period, 69 was elderly. It was a good age.
Yeah, it's a good age now, even.
Yes, absolutely.
So who did she name heir?
Well, she didn't really name anyone, but by living so long, the problem really resolved itself because by a strict hereditary, the person with the best claim to the throne was Mary, Queen of Scots' son, James VI of Scotland. He was the most high-ranking potential heir as well. He was a good Protestant on friendly terms with Elizabeth. So it just wasn't very plausible that it would be anyone other than him. The only other candidates were his cousin, Arbella Stuart, who was a girl, and also Catherine Grey's sons, who were of dubious legitimacy. So really, James was the only candidate, and he was one that most people were very happy with.
Right. So it all kind of worked out in the long run.
It did, yeah, and it was to do with her living so long. I mean, she solved the problem effectively.
Yeah, it all sort of worked. So did you find out that, do you think she was a smart queen, a very intelligent person?
Yes, absolutely, highly intelligent. She spoke a number of languages, was very, very intelligent, and an excellent political player. She knew exactly what was going on and ruled her kingdom herself.
Wow, it's amazing. So what would you say overall about Queen Elizabeth? If you had to say like three words, what would they be?
Three words to describe Queen Elizabeth. I would say strong, a survivor, pragmatic.
Oh, very good.
Thank you.
Well, excellent. Nice talking to you. And thank you very much for doing the show.
Yeah, no problem at all. Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The mission has been completed.
The end.
By George, he's got it. It is the end.
I'll see you.
This has been a production of the Z-Talk Radio Network.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.